Good afternoon or evening. Thank you all for coming and postponing your dinner by a few minutes at least. I'm Mike Bates. I'm excited to tell you today about C. Arnholt Smith, which is a sentence no one has said for, I'm certain, several decades. Some of what you will hear today was also included in an article I wrote for the Hardball Times over the off-season. Mr. San Diego, as he would come to be known, brought Major League Baseball to this city, along with Dodgers legendary executive Buzzy Bavasi, and then came a hair's breadth from taking it away to salvage his fortune after the full extent of his corruption came to light. Thankfully, he failed, which is why we get to be here in sunny San Diego today, rather than Washington, D.C., where it is rainy with a high of 95. So we'll get into that, but just after we begin at the start of his life. Conrad Arnholt Smith was born in 1899 in Walla Walla, Washington, but was forced to flee with his family at the age of seven when his father decided not to turn himself in after being convicted of perjury. Here you see on the left-hand side Arnholt with his mother and two siblings. He is on the far right, dapper-looking young man. And his father lit out for Southern California by himself. His father stopped running in San Diego, where he became a contractor, bought a house, and finally did send for his family. At the time, San Diego was booming. Here's a map of what it looked like in 1900 and a couple of images from around the time that Arnholt Smith and his family would have arrived. In 1900, the population was shy; it was just shy of 18,000 residents, but within 10 years, it had more than doubled in size, billing itself as the tuna capital of the world. The population continued to grow steadily throughout Smith's childhood, both putting a strain on the city's services and providing an opportunity for an ambitious kid. From an early age, Arnholt was hustling, working for his dad after school, as well as bagging groceries and gardening. And as World War I approached, he worried that he'd have to enlist. So he dropped out of high school to work full-time. After working as a series of jobs as a shoe shiner, a roustabout, and a baker's assistant, he was finally drafted into the Army and was sent to Texas. But the war ended before he could be deployed, and he returned to San Diego in 1922. Here's an image of him on the left-hand side in 1920. He got married in 1922. He returned to San Diego in late 1919. This is him in 1920 in his rowing uniform. He became employed by a bank. That bank was bought up by the Bank of Italy, which is now Bank of America. And there, Smith impressed his new bosses and quickly rose through the organization, eventually being relocated to Los Angeles. And the Los Angeles branch of the Bank of Italy is there on the right-hand side. And it's there in Los Angeles where he met Richard Nixon. Quote, "Nixon and I personally hit it off together. You know, Dick was a funny guy. When he was in public, he was an actor, just standing around like Napoleon. Yet when he was with only a few people, he was just as jovial and as easygoing as an average everyday guy. He'd loosen up." Yeah, he was famous for his looseness and his sense of humor, that Richard Nixon. When the Depression hit and his wife was tired of Los Angeles, Smith had the wild idea to try and buy a bank for himself and solicited money from friends and family to purchase a small insolvent institution called the U.S. National Bank of San Diego in 1933. On the left-hand, upper left, that is a photo of the main branch from that era. and it's on that rock where he began to build his empire. This empire eventually controlled more than $1 billion in bank deposits, a steel and shipbuilding company, pictured here on the lower left, the National Iron Works, a hotel. He helped build the Crystal Pier Hotel, which was a San Diego landmark. He owned the Yellow Cab Company in California, an airline, a tuna fleet. On the bottom right there is him at the launch of a ship or a christening. And was integral in the dredging of the harbor in 1948 that allowed San Diego to become the naval hub that it is today. Former Mayor Frank Curran said that, quote, he gave the downtown a facelift when it needed it badly. And UCSD Professor Steve Erie says, quote, anything that happened in this town required his approval and blessing. A small group of six or seven men ran San Diego, but he was at the top. Smith's financial reach eventually would lead him to baseball. In August of 1955, the San Diego Padres, then a minor league club in the Pacific Coast League, were in dire straits after their previous owner's attempts to build a stadium fell through. Quote, the owner, Bill Starr, Smith remembered, was having financial problems. He had an opportunity to sell the team to one of the cities upstate. And then when word got around that everybody, everybody screamed bloody murder. Geez, we can't let the team leave and things like that. Starr, who was banking with us, said, well, why the hell don't you buy it? And then you can handle the thing down here. It isn't too much money, and it would save my bacon. So, like a damn fool, I stepped up and said I'd help keep the team here in San Diego. So Smith bought the Padres through his Westgate, California tuna packing company for $250,000. There's his initial roster in 1955. The timing turned out obviously not to be ideal, as the Dodgers announced plans to move to Los Angeles in the winter of 1957. Arnholt and his brother John, an oil magnate with financial interests in Chavez Ravine, vehemently opposed the move and tried to force a public referendum on whether to hand the 300 acres and $5 million the city was planning to give the Dodgers. That effort succeeded. There was a public referendum, and Arnholt's brother John debated Walter O'Malley on live television the night before the election. But the results of the referendum went against the brothers, and Chavez Ravine belonged to the Dodgers. But even as critics predicted the death of the PCL, Smith was undaunted, opening the privately funded Westgate Park in the northeast part of what is now the Fashion Valley Mall in Mission Valley, just in time for the 1958 season, which was only 10 minutes from downtown San Diego, and would seat 7,000, but could be expanded to 35,000 if Major League Baseball ever wanted to move to the area. There are photos of it on opening day on the right-hand side here, along with a map in relation to the gas lamp quarter. The gentleman seated, looking out over the field there, is, of course, Hall of Famer Ralph Kiner, the team's general manager. The sporting news was effusive, with Earl Keller writing, quote, it's doubtful whether any park in the country, major or minor, has the beautiful setting of Westgate Park. It must be seen to be appreciated. Goes on to talk about the farms surrounding the park that Smith also owned, and the roof, which was a cantilever roof balanced into position by 19 pylons. It covered most of the seats in the ballpark to keep the sun off. If you've ever been to spring training games in Arizona, you can probably appreciate why that was so important. He said, Westgate Park is a tremendous credit to San Diego, and it could be the stepping stone to Major League Baseball here. Smith can take a bow for a tremendous accomplishment. It's this kind of civic leadership that earned Smith the moniker Mr. San Diego in 1961. According to the Los Angeles Times, quote, his influence in his adopted city was nonpareil, and his aggressive ways went largely unchallenged by the local news media. Smith used his bank to buy and expand existing businesses and create thousands of jobs for which he was lionized as a city benefactor, end quote. But he was something of an unknown quantity nationally and to Major League Baseball, according to Sporting News' Bob Ortman, who wrote, quote, although deeply involved in San Diego civic and business affairs and national activities of the Republican Party, Smith has escaped the glare of the spotlight. An impeccably neat dresser with a penchant for beige suits, he is seldom photographed and remains a mystery man to all but a select circle of friends. With so much of his own money invested in the new park and the Dodgers eating into his market share, there was no way for Smith to get out from under the Padres. So he did the next best thing. As the old saying goes, if you can't beat them, you join them. And when the American League began looking for ways to expand to the West Coast in the fall of 1960, Smith positioned himself as the solution to all their problems, teaming with Hank Greenberg to put together an offer for the expansion team. For most of the winter, they were in the lead, and in fact, the only candidates to own the Angels. But they couldn't reach a deal with LA owner Walter O'Malley over how to compensate them for coming into his territory, a prospect that surely seemed unpleasantly ironic to the San Diego mogul. With mere weeks to go before the expansion draft, Smith and Greenberg pulled out of negotiations, with Greenberg saying he didn't see how anyone could set up a successful operation in LA before the season started. But of course, that's just what Gene Autry did, leaving Smith again on the outside looking in as Major League Baseball bit deeper into his potential audience. But Smith was a patient guy and seems to have understood that Major League Baseball was eventually coming to San Diego, then approaching 700,000 residents. In 1968, he moved his Padres from Westgate to the newly constructed San Diego Stadium, which would come to be known as Jack Murphy and then Qualcomm Stadium, seen here under construction on the top left and after completion on the bottom left. It seated 45,000 in a tissue. I'm thinking of a Pacific Coast League team seating 45,000 in a stadium is kind of amazing. In anticipation of the National League's announcement in May that it was expanding and that Smith's ownership group, which included Bavese and Ralph Kiner, would get to turn the Padres into a major league operation for a $10 million fee. Smith was undoubtedly at the height of his influence in the spring of 1969. He had his brand new team, the inaugural Padres on the upper right, and the front page of the San Diego Union Tribune on the bottom right from opening day. His cool friend, his super cool, relaxed friend, Richard Nixon, had just been inaugurated, and he was a frequent guest at the White House. He was the most powerful man in San Diego, and he had turned the city into a major league town. He was beloved. I mean, if you're San Diego and you can't trust Mr. San Diego, then who can you trust? But his luck and his reputation were about to take an abrupt turn. First, the team drew just 513,000 fans in that inaugural season. And that fall, Smith began dropping hints already about the need to move the team if attendance didn't pick up, shades of the Pilots. Then incumbent and establishment Republican candidate Frank Curran was beaten by future California Senator and Governor Pete Wilson in the race for San Diego mayor. And Wilson proceeded to restructure the city council and campaign contribution rules to begin to limit the influence of Smith and his cronies. In the fall of 1971, after reportedly losing more than $2 million in the franchise's first three seasons, Smith began listening to offers on the club, most of them coming from Washington, which had twice been abandoned by the American League in the last decade. The offers were rebuffed, but there was blood in the water, and fans began a Save Our Padres campaign. In 1972, Smith secured the Republican National Convention for his adopted hometown, but a corruption scandal, in which a telephone company contributed $400,000 toward the convention in exchange for preferential treatment from Nixon's Department of Justice, prompted the party to move the convention into Miami just weeks before the event. And Mr. San Diego seemed to have lost his touch. But those were just symbolic losses. The situation became far more dire for Smith in May of 1973, when just 5 months after Bavese called Smith, quote, Santa Claus in baseball, for refusing to move the Padres yet again, the Securities and Exchange Commission filed suit against the U.S. National Bank. Smith and many others for, according to the write-up in the New York Times, quote, engaging in a fraudulent scheme to appropriate the assets of Westgate and the U.S. National Bank in San Diego for their own use. The suit added that they created ostensible profits for Westgate and published false and misleading statements of these profits to camouflage the unlawful activities. So among other things, Smith and his associates were accused of selling their assets to buyers who obtained cash for those to buy those assets from Smith's own bank, allowing him to remain in control of those assets without having to list them as liabilities. The bank was ordered to liquidate all of the loans on these fraudulent purchases and was ruled insolvent. At the time, it was the largest bank failure in the history of the United States. In what was surely just an amazing coincidence, 4 days before he was named in that SEC suit, Smith finally pulled the trigger and agreed to sell the Padres to an ownership group in Washington, D.C. for the largest price tag in baseball history. Quote, when the city heard about it, he recalled, they were ready to tar and feather me for losing the team for San Diego. I don't know who the hell they thought the team belonged to, end quote. Charming. He would proceed to liquidate a number of other assets, and while he denied it, saying, quote, I just wanted to get rid of the team because we were losing our shirt in the damn thing, it seemed clear that this sale and the others were designed to help him cover whatever fines and debts he was about to incur in what was sure to be a costly and lengthy legal process. While Smith was putting the final touches on the team's sale to a Washington syndicate, who were demanding to have input on roster decisions at the time, Buzzy Bavasi was working behind the scenes to try to salvage San Diego as a major market, including talking to Japanese investors. And Bavasi is really a hero of this story as far as San Diego is concerned. Because after Smith, the good news was that while Smith was announcing the deal in the middle of the season, Bavasi had plenty of time to maneuver. But there were other complications. The Padres were only 5 years into a 20-year lease, for one thing, and any abdication of that lease was going to require paying a significant penalty. Also, the National League was unenthusiastic about the Padres being moved to a city where baseball had failed twice before, and the IRS was putting a $22 million lien on Smith's assets. And in October of 1973, Smith was being charged with evading taxes, federal income taxes, and NL President Chubb Feeney announced that the league would not allow the Padres to move without more time to study the issue. With the process stalled, Smith announced that he suddenly had new mystery investors, turned out to be a racetrack owner who was disgraced in Chicago, and so that was a poor prospect for major league ownership. And it really looked like, you know, even with that additional time, Smith was not going to find a local buyer. Bavasi was devastated, telling Phil Collier of the Sporting News, last night we were assured that we had the club for San Diego, and we woke up this morning and found out Mr. Smith had changed his mind. He changed his mind in the lives of a lot of people. The reactions were angry. The recently acquired Willie McCovey threatened to retire. Mayor Wilson and the city's attorney promised a legal response that would challenge the MLB's antitrust exemption. And finally, Bavasi came through with a last-ditch compromise offer. Quote, Buzzy called me up one day, Smith recalled in his two-part interview with the San Diego Reader in 1992, and said, hey, I want you to have lunch with some people that might be interested in the Padres. Some man sitting next to me at a table who I'd never seen before, and we talked about everything under the sun except the Padres. So he says to me, I hear you own the Padres. And he said, yes, I control it. And he said to me, I hear you might possibly sell it. I said, yeah, I'm thinking about it. What do you want for it? It's a great negotiation. He caught me flat-footed. I didn't know what to say, so I said, well, $12.5 million. He thought for a minute. He said, I'll take it. And that was it. He said, I'll have my lawyers get in touch with you. So as we were moving out, I got alongside of Bavasi and said, Christ, who the hell is that jerk? Bavasi says, geez, don't you know? He's the guy that owns McDonald's. And so Ray Kroc saved the Padres in early February of 1974, but no one could save Smith. The Padres, quote, the Padres are another case of something that I did that brought credit and profit to somebody in the community. It's helped put San Diego on the map, and yet I felt like I was walking away with nothing, Smith complained years later. In 1975, the feds charged him with bank fraud and making illegal contributions to the Nixon campaign. He was in good company there. They arrested him later that year. He was also charged with embezzling almost $9 million from his various businesses. Convicted in 1979, he served 8 months and then lived the rest of his life in relative obscurity with his daughter, his only income being from Social Security. He died in 1996 at the age of 97 of heart failure after a short stay at a nursing home. There are reports that his ghost still inhabits a bar or restaurant somewhere here in San Diego that he used to own. I'm saying that for my friend Michael Clare, who can't be here today. It's a complicated legacy for a man who both started and ended his life with nothing, but who in between built a city and a fortune. No one was more entwined with San Diego than C. Arnholt Smith. He was unquestionably its leading citizen. He transformed it into a major league town, and then, in greed and desperation, he betrayed it, as he did the thousands of San Diegans he left in financial ruin. But in spite of Smith's best efforts, at least they still have their Padres. And if you like this story, I tell many more like it. Here are references. If you like this story, I tell many more like it every week on my with my friend and collaborator Bill Parker on our podcast This Week in Baseball History. If you're interested in learning more or subscribing to get a new episode every week, please feel free to talk to either one of us after this. We'd be happy to talk to you. And if you don't know how to subscribe to a podcast, set that up for you. So thanks. And I'll take any questions. Yes?
How involved was Smith with the baseball team, the day-to-day activities?
He was not terribly involved in the day-to-day activities. He set the payroll, and he was very much a hands-off owner from what I've picked up from the reading. He was a man behind the curtain and a silent partner, allowing Bevesi to be the and Kiner to be the faces of the franchise. But they didn't try to sell it to Washington. So, okay. Well, thank you guys. Appreciate it.